Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, as you can see on the sign behind me, which is new. I've been putting it everywhere. Thanks for tuning in to another of our virtual events. We are delighted to have Chris. Is it Houghty or Houghty? I should have established that beforehand.
Houghty.
Houghty.
Fourth book in, we're going to get that right, Patrick. Houghty.
Houghty, I'll get it.
It's absolutely no problem.
And then, let's see, and this is the brand new book called The Devil You Know. And Chris has signed a batch of books for us. Here we go. And I'll put a link in the comments field should you wish to purchase one. And if you have questions, go ahead and put those in as well. And Barbara will summon me on screen towards the end of the hour. I'll be happy to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I'm going to respell your name, Chris. I'm going to spell it H-A-U-G-H-T-Y, and then we can't screw it up, right?
Or you can spell it H-O-T-T-I-E. He's a hottie.
That's a slightly different pronunciation. That's hottie, not hottie. Right. We have to get those diphthongs correct. Anyway, with him, as I understand, his well-rehearsed partner in crime and act on the road, Douglas Steinberg. So they are going to be, I hope, amusing you. But before, I have a thought or two to present to you, which is this is the second book in a week that I have discussed with an author where a justice of the Supreme Court is either the bad actor or, in your case, the victim. And I find this fascinating that two people whose books have been, you know, in the works for some time have suddenly come out with not the president like David Baldacci did in Absolute Power when he was a, you know, serial rapist and killer, not an evil congressman or corrupt head of the CIA or whatever it may be, but we have moved to the Supreme Court, which I think kind of reflects what's going on in the world right now. There's a zeitgeist moment here. Did you tap into that, Mr. Houghty?
Well, I'm beginning to like that. I'd like to say that I was tapping into something that was going on today, but I actually started the book before the Supreme Court became such a hot button issue. I was really determined with this fourth book to avoid the hot button topics and more topical issues. And there I went again. As I was beginning to write it, things began to get very interesting at the court. So pure happenstance. You know, I think I'd covered the White House and the Supreme Court. I think we can all agree is probably far more impactful than any U.S. president on a given day. So it seemed like a good place to go.
I know, but see, I'm not at all convinced because I like to think that lots of writers, especially in the crime genre, have a kind of thing about the zeitgeist going on in their head that they probably don't even realize. Although it may just be that they were looking for like the last potential villain or victim standing in Washington that had already been through the thriller mills. So who knows? But anyway, I do find it a very interesting. I'm going to recommend Ellen Crosby's book, Blow Up, which I discussed with her last Saturday. It's a really amazing book and perhaps slightly more savage about the court than yours. Anyway, with that, I'm going to turn this over to Doug.
Oh, okay.
That's you, Doug.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here and to interview my good friend, Chris, about his book. Now, Chris, you've written how many books?
Four and a half
books. And four of them have to do with Haley Chill.
Four and a half of them have to do with Haley Chill. That's
yeah.
Correct.
So what happens? Why suddenly in in The Devil You Know, how come suddenly she seems so deep? She's much deeper than she was. You probed, you gave her alcoholism.
Well, she had certainly in the first book, she, you know, that was one of her problems. I guess it wasn't as much a problem in the earlier books with her drinking, but she would let off steam and find her partners and find her combatants in bars after you know, long nights of drinking, but then she would get her act together the next day and be able to perform. And it seemed like after three books of that, it was time to really look at that as something more than a character trait and treat it as a problem that, you know, it very well could be. So at the end of book three, at the end of Storm Rising, she's gone through an awful lot. She's experienced a lot of loss in that book, personal loss. She accomplishes her agenda, but at great sacrifice. And so when we pick up her story with The Devil You Know, she is, I would say she's doing more than licking her wounds. She's really kind of hiding all her sorrows and grief at the bottom of a, you know, tequila bottle.
Right. So on the surface, from what I was reading, Chris writes his character who's got a personal conflict with herself. And then he uses a device that allows us, without exposition, that is to say, without prose, but through dialogue, to discover what she's thinking. And what is that device? I hope you remember your own device.
You guys were as well rehearsed as I was led to believe.
Thinking what I wanted to do before I started, we really jumped into the deep end right away, and I appreciate Barbara and Doug. But what I wanted to do first, Barbara, was to first welcome my good buddy Douglas and introduce why he's here. Douglas, and I've told this story many times at other book events. You know, people always ask, how did you, you were a screenwriter for three decades. Why did you make that transition? And this is the guy. I mean, if Douglas and I hadn't had lunch, I don't know how many years ago, 5 years ago, and he told me that he was writing a novel, that kind of writing exercise had never occurred to me, honestly, in three decades. And so Douglas was doing it, and Douglas is the guy who encouraged me to put aside the screenplay format and try something else. So it's one of the most fortuitous transitions in the history of mankind, but something a little bit less than that. The other thing I wanted to say is we are sitting in the office, the upstairs office of Book Soup in West Hollywood, Los Angeles. And the folks here at Book Soup were kind enough to turn over their marketing office above the store so that we could do this quick turnaround. We have an event here at Book Soup at 7 p.m., 5 p.m. with you all. So kudos to them. These folks have hosted me for every book except for the pandemic book. So I'm very grateful for Dan and Emma, right? Yeah, for giving up their office and having to put up with us. So anyway, the device. What were you saying about my device? You know,
she's talking to her late partner, which is never fails, like Blythe Spirit with Noel Coward. It just always works.
Yeah, well, you know, she's a lone wolf. I mean, I heard the conception of Haley Chills as a lone wolf, and that's what we love about her. She's sort of the samurai soldier, a samurai who's, you know, wandering the heath and speaking to spirits before she goes into battle. And readers really responded to April Wu as a character in the first and second book. And in the process of writing that second book, I don't think that I'm going to spoil it for anybody. It's not much of a spoiler to say that the April Wu, who began as a rival of Haley Chill, ends up her best friend and confidant. April Wu dies tragically at the end of the second book. And I wanted to keep her around, and keeping her around as, you know, I fudge it a little bit. I don't come out right out and say she's a ghost or she's a bit of undigested beef in Haley's stomach, or just her conscience. But you know, it's just someone that inner voice or inner person that my lone wolf samurai warrior can unburden herself with, and also get a little, you know, I mean, April usually gives her shit, you know,
because right, she's arguing with herself essentially. Yes, Haley, and yeah, through this device
to help Haley not take herself so seriously,
right, and breaking down mysteries and or complications or clues, which is a great device. In fact, why don't you tell us how, you know, you've been a very successful screenwriter for years. How does that work when you write prose? Do you have this instinct to keep it moving? Because it doesn't bog down ever, you know?
Oh, I think I've brought all my anxieties and insecurities as a screenwriter, which is trying to get someone to read your damn script, which is not an easy task. And you have to write in such a way that you grab your reader, your producer, your studio exec, or your movie star, and they're going to keep turning the pages. So
yeah,
as screenwriters, we're trained that way. I'm sure, you know, no novelist sits down and goes, how can I really bog things down and bore my reader to death? But I do think that screenwriters, and Barbara, you can speak to this, you know, the successful novelists who are also active screenwriters, you notice a style that they've brought with them to writing their books, or do they seem just like another good thriller novel or crime novel?
I think people who are used to screenwriting, A, tend to see things. They tend to, you know, have sort of a visual picture of what's going on. But, you know, screenwriting is strong on dialogue and pretty sketchy about landscape and background, because you can just say, you know, church, you know, and
yes,
yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. So I think for screenwriters, I'm trying to think who it was I just talked to about this. Some of them have a really hard time going past dialogue to, you know, setting the screen, I mean, setting the scene. And yeah, and describing the action, because in screenwriting, you assume the actors, you just say, you know, fight scene or something, and there it goes. But I also find that screenwriters absolutely love the solo work of writing the novel, because screenwriting is so collaborative, and, you yes, know, and you can be overruled. And then your, you know, your book can be, I mean, your script can be changed by the actor or changed by the director. So, I mean, the only writer I really talked to who actually, as a good novelist, prefers screenwriting is Dennis Lehane. He absolutely loves screenwriting. And part of it, he said, is because it doesn't take as much time as a book. You know, it's a lot shorter. He has more time for his family. He could knock out a screenplay, you know, almost anywhere, because he's focusing on fewer things.
Yeah. And I think Dennis Lehane probably experienced less interference than your typical screenwriter, is my guess. I mean, it is a collaborative business.
Right.
There are different degrees of collaboration yeah, that's foisted upon you as a
screenwriter. I can't think of her name at the moment, my apologies, but a really interesting woman who had, as we often do, debut novels, because we seem to, you know, talk to them a lot. And she came with her debut novel, and I discovered, I wish I could remember the name of the TV thing at the moment. Anyway, it was a TV series I loved and I had watched. And at the end, basically all the characters go down. And one of them in particular was heartbreaking. And so somehow in our introductory conversation, she allowed us how she was a writer on this TV show. And she was the one that had written the script and killed this woman. I was like, I almost killed her. It was a near thing, you know, because I was so unhappy that the woman had died. I wish I could, you'd probably remember what it is, but I'm sorry. Patrick, save me here. It went on for ages, and it started out with security cameras and a kind of surveillance thing. And it ended up being kind of a battle between two computer-driven organizations. Person of interest. Thank you. That is indeed it. I just couldn't think of it. Patrick and I have a well-rehearsed thing here where I can't remember things and he uses the chat function to tell me what it is. And the author was Melissa Scrivener, love. That, right, so got all that worked out. Anyway, she was much happier to be a novelist than she had been as a screenwriter for many, and part of it was the autonomy. And then part of it may be, although I don't remember she said that, that she actually liked writing in the landscape and, you know, all those things that a screenwriter can leave to the visual part. So everybody's brain works differently.
I had a playwriting teacher who used to describe dramatic writing as a vulgar form. The reason being is you have to glean what people are thinking from their dialogue and from their actions. Whereas when you, depending on your point of view, a first or third or close third, whatever. But the thing is you can get into thoughts succinctly. And that's the difference, because it's harder to write with your hands cuffed. But when you can say what more succinctly what somebody's thinking or what their intentions are, it makes it a lot easier. You can imagine how do you get that out of a line of dialogue? It's all about subtext and you have to build it. It's pretty difficult. So it must be freeing up a bit to write prose.
Very freeing. Yeah. It's taken a while to kind of, I mean, I think with each book I've left screenwriting behind kind of increasingly, because I made probably more than one mistake, but one mistake that was brought to my attention with the first book, with Deep State, one of the reviewers or reader, I can't remember how I was made aware of this, but I actually wrote a line in the book that said something like, "We see Haley climb the stairs," and that's how you, that's screenplay, yeah. Is we see, you know, that's, yeah. That's your telling the camera operator, that's what we're going to follow. Sure. But I don't think I make those mistakes anymore.
Why would you? But, you know, conversely, there are at least, I can think of in particular, some books that, because there's so much interior dialogue and landscape, they make terrible transition to television unless they're rewritten. And that would be Tony Hillerman's books, for example. The first pass at trying to do those, because it's almost all interior writing, you know, and thoughts. And yeah. So they didn't do well. There's a new pass at them in which they've made a whole lot of adjustments. But so not, you know, not every novels do well translated visually unless the screenwriter is able to surgically, you know, deal with it.
Yeah, it's a real interpretation of a book. I did some adaptations that never got made, and it's you're interpreting a book, and that's
right.
Why more often than not, I think the Dennis Lehane is an exception. Usually, the author, a book's author, is not the ideal person to adapt their book for screen, for film, right, or TV.
But he had a lot of practice, you know, writing for television that wasn't about his books. So yeah. I think that probably made it a lot easier for him, because he had that whole, you know, thing going on with authors like George Pell, The Wire, you know, that kind of thing.
Writing for television is a great academy. You know, you get paid to learn, and also you get paid to get beaten up by your superiors, and that it's a regular thing. And you go right down to your bone marrow doubting yourself. And then when if you come out the other side, you kind of have a little more confidence. It's amazing. People think it's all just wonderful in Hollywood. It's just Marat Saad.
Well, that's what they're talking about in the current writer's strike. And both Doug and I are writers guild members, and I mean, one of the key arguments is the existence of exactly what Douglas is referring to, which is, it's almost like an apprenticeship program. You really start at a certain low level and you work your way up, and showrunners, the guys who are in charge of the show, who are writers and producers at the same time, most of them, probably not all of them, but they take great pains to train the writers coming up, because it's not just writing, it's creating a show.
Yeah, it's a whole different set of muscles that have to be strengthened until it becomes instinct. But And then I think, you know, then to go and tell a story in prose is like almost like lying in a puffy bed, you know, what do you think?
It was very much like lying in a puffy bed after that lunch that I had with Douglas 4 or 5 years ago. I just thought I would try it on for size, and I wrote for a day, and it seemed to go pretty well. And the second day was even better, and I just found totally new ways to tell a story that, you know, were not a part of my screenwriting toolbox.
Yeah. So I went and looked up the New York Times review of, which book is it here? Deep State.
Yes.
And I thought that they, what did I just lose it here? Rats. They had a description of Haley that I thought was particularly interesting in terms of how they defined her, that, you know, she was... how did I manage to just change that? Do you remember what they said about her?
Amazingly enough, I do not have my New York Times book review
memorized.
It's some.
I'm so sorry. Anyway, they talked about her relentless focus and her, her combat, you know, training and. At all, and in just, if I can find this again, in just 4 lines, they managed to, I think the problem is I'm in the wrong book here. Hang on a minute. Ah, here we go. I lost it. Now I found it again. Okay. Not with her photographic memory, superb physical conditioning, relentless focus, and expertise at one-to-one combat. I thought, wow, you know, is that the way you wrote Haley Jill, is that, you know, because this is how the Times reviewer sees her. Is that an accurate picture?
I would say that's a distillation of her. Some readers have commented sometimes unfavorably that she's a superwoman. And I never conceived of her in that way. My agenda was to create a character who did not have vast resources or seemingly extensive training to take on the deep state. You know, my intention was to create an intern in the White House who, you know, would seemingly have nothing more than basic army training and I think 2 years of college, community college education. That was the whole point, was to create a character who was not invincible. I think those attributes, except for the photographic memory, they speak to character more than a skill set or training or superhuman capabilities. It's really her, it's her determination and her relentlessness and a pretty concise ideology that propels her to kind of barrel through the obstacles I throw in her place.
Where did she get this training? I mean, you know, people don't just arrive from high school with that particular skill set. Where did she learn it?
Well, that was the little sleight of hand in the first book that I had to play with, because for probably 4/5 of that book, we think that she's just a kind of a kick-ass woman from the wrong side of the tracks in West Virginia, who's resourceful, but seemingly all alone in her battle against the deep state. It's not till the end of the book, essentially a long codicine, where we learn that she's been trained, that she's not just an intern, that she's this operative for the deeper state,
right.
And there she did receive physical training, close combat training, and I think some language training as well.
But you know what we can all identify with is that she's in every person, every woman. You know, in other words, she's underestimated all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's what's so appealing about her. People think that she's some rube or some, they don't know, but we know. as we're reading. And it feels very good when she's right and proves others wrong.
You know, they're meant to, people, her foes, her opponents are usually sketched to underestimate her for her gender, her accent, and usually her position. You know, it's never she's not an FBI agent. She's not a Secret Service agent. She's not, in most books, she actually is an FBI agent in this latest book. But in terms of her in the beginning, it was definitely an attempt to create an every woman type of character.
Also, you have in the book several storylines that we see they're going to collide. We don't know how it's going to happen. And you keep them, the balls in the air all the time. And that almost helps you create a ticking clock. Like you reach a point, then you go to the next tension, build that up, then you know. And how do you feel that rhythm? Is it just by natural inclination or?
Well, that's the trickery of the latest book, The Devil You Know. I create literally two ticking clocks, two completely disparate arenas of threat and peril, with this fairly extreme threat against the Supreme Court justice. And that's Haley Chill's primary objective, is to protect this Supreme Court justice. Meanwhile, at the same time, the setting is on Maui, on a different part of the island. A whole school bus of school kids have literally disappeared from the face of the earth. And no one sees any link between these two incidents. There's really no reason to think that they're linked. And it's up to Haley to ultimately see that possible link and then find some way to resolve them as the two storylines merge. It was fun to write that. You know, it's fun to have a lot of balls in the air, because you don't have to worry about things getting too draggy in your novel.
And it's also suspenseful. It's not so, there's some run and jump, which is always exciting, but it's more suspenseful than the other novels, which is tension. And I really, you know, it's really good stuff. Yeah.
Thank you, Douglas.
You're welcome.
Realize that I have done Mark Cameron an injustice here. Actually, this is the third Supreme Court justice book that I have read, because in Mark's most recent book, which we discussed last Monday, we have a woman who's just becoming a Supreme Court justice who decides to take a vacation to Alaska with her daughter before all that happens. And there's the whole pressure thing, which is not dissimilar to what happens in your book. And, you know, you recognize that a justice, although we're having a little trouble with this concept right at the moment, but in theory, a justice should be looking only at the facts and the law and not be influenced by, you know, anything personal or any kind of pressure group or any kind of lobbyist or something. But you can see that the stakes for someone or other with a case coming towards the court could be very, very high if they were able to suborn or pressure a justice, which was the point of Mark's book. And, you know,
I guess
doing a Supreme Court justice in theory takes it to the highest stakes there are in the highest court in the land.
Yeah. The stakes are obvious, you know, like, I think the natural assumption, since we're living in a very polarized political environment these days, I think the natural assumption, if someone's threatening to take out one or more Supreme Court justices, that it's political motivation. And so I knew from the get-go that, again, I don't think I'm spoiling too much to set that expectation up and then ultimately dash those expectations. But I think the reason why people, I mean, it is in the zeitgeist, the Supreme Court is in the air, but all of these books, probably knowing the production schedules for publishing houses, they were all started long before, you know, we're talking about the Supreme Court justice in the news the way that we're talking about it. But I think prior to a lot of this more recent news coverage, the Supreme Court just seemed very, you know, we didn't know much about those guys and women. They just were, unless you're a real, you know, news junkie or political wonk, I mean, they just existed, you know, up there on their dais and dressed in their robes. We didn't really think of them as...
They were Vestal virgins. They were incorruptible.
That's the goal. That's the ideal. But as we've discovered, they are real people. But so that's why one of my motivations, and the original idea came from just a friend saying, I have a good idea for a thriller. And usually people say that and you kind of nod your head and smile politely. And then you go back to thinking about what your grocery list is. But someone said, what if someone's taking out Supreme Court justices? And that was the genesis of this book.
And that person is now suing.
Suing me, taking me. Demanding the spoils. But I wanted to kind of get to know a Supreme Court justice in my book. So that was a fun activity to create someone, you know, with a life beneath those robes.
Right. We have a lot of feints and surprises too, which keeps us, you know, we think we know where we're going and then you reverse it and then we double down like any great mysteries. Mm-hmm. It's pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you gave yourself the hardship of having to set this book in Hawaii. For you, were you able to go there and do on the spot research now that we're past the no travel, you know, the travel bans?
Yeah. I went at that part of the pandemic when it was still a challenge to fly. Hawaii was quite intense with their controls. And so you had to get a special card and proof. And it was more than, you know, driving from California to Arizona, that was for sure. But I had never been to Hawaii before my trip there for this book. And so spent a little bit of time on the Big Island and then went to Maui and decided that was the place I really wanted to set the book in. It seemed...
You said you cast your first draft into the volcano there.
Yeah, well, yeah. I pushed my guide.
Did you go up to Haleakala and just toss it? I love it. Why did you pick Maui?
Why did I pick Maui? Yeah. I liked the jungle aspect of it. I liked that it had both the kind of razzmatazz of the big hotels and big resorts, but also had, you know, in the midsection, in the upcountry, it's sort of in the shadow of the volcano. It's much different. And that's where a lot of the school kids part of the story is set in. And those, you know, those people have lived there for generations, and you have a real mix of affluence and natives and people who were just blue collar folks. And so that was appealing to me. And then also just the geographical diversity of that island is phenomenal. So I covered that entire island, at least drove kind of every aspect of it from the volcano all the way out to Hana and then all the way back on the what would that be, the southern shore. You know, Barbara, sometimes it's just like wherever you land as an author, I think, you know, I'm a firm believer, if I, you know, plot me down in any town in the US, then I'll find something of note to make it into the book. What I've been doing increasingly with each book is traveling to these places, experiencing some of the things, you know, and they're just simple things like restaurants or the drive up to the volcano or you know, the famous surfing and water windsurfing spot on the north shore of Hawaii, of Maui, and just incorporating whatever happens to me in those places I put in the book, and it just gives it that extra level of authenticity and detail.
Oh, so, I'm totally agree with you. I mean, you know, I've been to all the Hawaiian Islands, and Maui is the one in many ways the most impacted by tourism in concentrated areas over the, you know, decades that I've been going there. Interestingly enough, my husband and I last year ago, a little more than a year ago, were very fond of a sailing yacht called the Wind Spirit, which is part of the Windstar cruise line. It's very small. It's like 120 people or something. And they apparently have decided to leave one. There are two of them in French Polynesia. So it's a lovely 7-day kind of a yacht sail around it. And it was our first trip, you know, post-pandemic. And you had to, as you point out, go through a lot of hoops, you know, to get to San Francisco. And then it's, you know, you had to go through all kinds of testing and stuff where they let you on the flight to Tahiti. But what here's what I learned, which I found fascinating. It's the same chain as Hawaii. It's on the other side of the equator. And you don't go over the international date line. So it's only a little bit farther than Hawaii, but it's French overlaying the, you know, the Polynesian, the, you know, this is Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, which is sort of why I'm saying this, because I'm giving it a little bit of plug. But
we still I know where book five is going to be set.
But for tourism, it's astonishing because they don't get maybe 200,000 people a year, whereas Hawaii gets 10 million people a year. So the experience in French Polynesia, which of course is very much like Hawaii, you know, looks a lot like Hawaii, feels a lot like it in many ways, is completely different. And the part I love the most is Bora Bora, which is the one, you know, it has the over the water hales, and, you know, it's also exciting, and the cruise ships stop there now. And the reason is that the volcano, when it collapsed, you know, the caldera left this beautiful lagoon. But the reason that cruise ships can go there, I had no idea this was true, was right after Pearl Harbor, the U.S. Navy decided to take what was left and take it to safety at Bora Bora. And to do that, they blasted through the coral reef. So they destroyed, you know, a chunk of the reef, and that's why ships can go into it. That's what I love about travel. I mean, would you ever have really known that?
No. Let me put on your editorial hat for a second, Barbara. If you had your author hat, if you were writing a thriller, your author's thriller, which island, which Hawaiian island would you... You have a lot of experience with Hawaii, more than I do. So
it sort of depends on what action you want. I mean, I had a dorm mate when I was in Stanford back in the 50s who lived in Kauai, which at that point was so rural, you know, that probably nobody heard of it. Now it's more prominent because they filmed Jurassic Park or whatever the sequel to Jurassic Park was. So if you're looking for something more remote, you know, Kauai would be the obvious choice. If you're looking to where more action is, because of the tourism and the whole bit, Maui would probably be your best bet. The Big Island is the most diverse in terms of climate because the east side of it is very humid and kind of jungly, and the west coast is, you know, quite different. And it's, I mean, although Maui gets a ton of tourists and ships and all, I think the Big Island might have the most actual number of visitors. And it feels less Hawaiian in a lot of ways. You know, it's more Californian at this point. So I think Maui was a good choice, you know, for what you wanted to do. I think Kauai would have been too remote for you. And there are a couple of other, you know, smaller islands, but they wouldn't have enough presence for what you want to do. But I was throwing Tahiti at you because if you really like Hawaii, I'm going to recommend, you know, French Polynesia has all kinds of things going for it.
Sounds great. About the end of the book, which I won't reveal, but do we see a future with Haley, or do you not want to say anything?
I can't.
Don't have to.
Well, here's what I'll say about that. The four books or four and a half books, I think where Haley ends up in this book, she's not finished. Definitely there's a sense of continuance with that. You know, she certainly isn't deceased at the end of book four. But what I'm trying to say is that this sort of part of her story is completed, I think, in the four books, these first four books, because the first three books, you know, have the one piece of connective tissue is about her father. And, right. And really, you know, the third book, Storm Rising, she is really getting down to the truth about the nature of her father's death, what he was up to. And there's some fairly dramatic redemption in the completion of that arc. But like I said earlier, she's really gotten her butt kicked by the end of that third book, Storm Rising. And so with The Devil You Know, it's really kind of her chance to kind of resolve some of these character flaws and problems and kind of and center herself again. So by the end of the book, she's centered and ready to kind of move forward and save the day next time the day needs saving. The next book, I really can't talk about.
Okay.
There's some.
I think when you're doing a backstory arc, like the whole question of her father, there's a limit to how many books you can draw it out.
For sure.
At some point, that story arc needs to come to rest, and then you can start a new one or not, as the case may be. And, you know, this is a reasonable length of time for you to have explored that.
Yeah. And the topic really isn't, that storyline, the father storyline, is really ended with the third book. Like I said, it's like, this is almost like the fourth book is just sort of the recovery with all this other stuff going on between the school kids and the Supreme Court justice. It's like also, you know, the personal story of Haley's, you know, finding center again. That's the only way I can think of it, of describing it. I haven't figured it out yet, but there's a similar storyline for her that I would like to explore that has that kind of personal relevance for her.
This book is in the ether, by the way. I was just telling Chris on my drive, before I left to drive here for this meeting, I got an email from Amazon and this was there. So it's catching on, I think. How did that happen? I don't know.
We don't say the word Amazon here, though.
I didn't mean to say it.
No, it's okay. Actually, I'm very fond of Amazon Publishing because I think they do some very good work with authors who might not be able to do some of those things. So I work a lot with Amazon. I've got Bob Dugoni, whose career Amazon saved, coming down with his editor to do an event in October. So, yes. Yeah. So you don't need to worry about, and actually I'm a Barnes & Noble bookseller. So, you know, I work with them too. I think we're all in this together. Yeah. And, you know, the poison pen is not all that large, and there's no way that we can encompass the universe of books that these other retailers do. And, you know,
all books are good for other books that are waiting to be sold, I think.
So. And a lot of books burn longer than other books, which is always a good thing.
Yeah.
We're not going to talk politics.
Let's not talk politics now. I made that mistake earlier today. Now, you know, it's getting harder and harder not to, just because every day there's some new outrage. You know, I could hardly believe it that Ron DeSantis today, you know, says that if he's late, he's going to pardon all the... When I think of all the work that went into trying to deal with the January 6th thing, and now we have both Trump and DeSantis saying we're going to pardon it. And then, you know, you look at the justice system and you think it's almost becoming a joke if, you know, if that kind of thing can happen. in powers that were written into the Constitution, like the presidential pardon, nobody ever thought it would be suborned in that direction. Just like, as somebody pointed out to me recently, and I thought about it, when the Constitution was drafted, people didn't live to be so old. Most people, you know, died in their 50s or 60s. They didn't envision career politicians or people sitting on the court until, you know, for decades and all. And so in many ways, some of the Constitution, and I say this as a real student of it, really needs updating in terms of, you know, how things have evolved. I'm a foe of the Electoral College, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, but you've got the originalists to deal with. How are you going to do that? You know, you can't change a world.
I don't really know any way to resolve all the different threads that are going on. And then I read, I've been saying for the last almost year that the head of the Wagner Group was going to end up fomenting a revolution, that this war was going to unseat Putin and there would be a coup, and the Wagner guy was the guy that was going to do it. And guess what? You know, reading the paper today, you can sort of see that I'm not that far off. Yeah. So, you know, and then the New York Times ran a whole thing last Sunday, wasn't it, about the problem with Xi in China is that by suppressing all possible rivals, he's left no succession plan. You know, so if anything happens to him, it's like up for grabs. And that's what these guys do when they, you know, create a state that just depends on them. There's always instability and tumult and all when they're gone, because none of them is immortal, and you don't even know what to expect. So I think the whole world is kind of at the moment in this chaotic state.
I always thought Prigozhin's private army was like the palace guard for Putin, but it's in history, you notice palace guards often overthrow their boss.
All the way back to Rome, you know, the Praetorian Guards, they were the guys that determined, you know, a lot of emperors. So, yeah, I mean, it's really dangerous to start dealing with stuff like that. And that's what worries me about mobilizing different parts of our government to be almost, in effect, you know, private armies and so forth. It's hard when there's no consensus, when dissensus is, you know, if anybody read Federalist Papers, we had to read them when I was in high school. People actually had to read the Federalist Papers. And Federalist Paper number 10 is the one we're looking at. And that's the one that said that when we get to a tyranny of minorities, the majority can't hold and democracy will fail. And I think that's, you know, very close to where we are. So that's a gloomy note, right? But, you know, every day I read the paper, I think I'm just going to restrict myself to the funnies and the Bridgian. just let it go. But, you know, as thriller writers, you've got a chance, Chris, you know, to really address some of these issues in a way in fiction that, you know, may have a more profound effect on your readers than the New York Times.
I mean, I think that's what I've been doing, less so with this new book, but the Storm Rising, you know, as a topic of focused on white supremacy in the U.S. military, you know, sometimes I don't know if I'm doing myself any justice in being quite that on point of a starting place for creating my fictions. But I've always kind of looked to what I'm experiencing when I'm an avid news reader and consumer of current events, and that totally filters into my work as an author. Again, I don't know if I'm doing myself any favors, because I think in some ways people really, readers, genre readers, you know, might not want to confront the issues that they're seeing on Fox or CNN or in the Washington Post or Washington Times. They really just want to escape. And so I did go with, you know, I led with that goal in mind with The Devil You Know, because Storm Rising was an exhausting book for me to write. I wrote it in the, you know, smack dab in 2020, and when all hell was breaking loose in the country. And I think that I was, I think some of that craziness and darkness ended up on the pages of Storm Rising. And so The Devil You Know was a, you know, as Doug was saying earlier about this sort of creating the, you know, the dual ticking clocks, I really just wanted to craft something that was, you know, it's an overused phrase, but a real thrill ride with the book. And seemed to be, you know, judging by early reads, people seem to be taking it as such, as something that's a real, again, we've heard it before a million times, but
well, you know, this one reason historical fiction's on the rise, because, you know, it's a lot easier to write about stuff that already happened, where we know how it came out, but you can present the same issues we're facing in historical fiction, because none of this is new. You know, it's new to us, but it's not new. So
I think what I do is, it's sort of a subset of that kind of historical fiction, because I do pull so much out of the news or recent history, and it ends up in the books. I like to take those things and just twist them around, and so that the reader will recognize, they'll go, oh yeah, I remember, like, when, you know, whatever, the Turkish ambassador's henchmen beat up a bunch of protesters in Washington, D.C. I mean, I put that in the first book. But then, you know, camouflage it, twist it around, give it a different ending. But
the truth is, every book you write becomes historical fiction.
Yeah.
You know, because life moves on, and you know, and it's looking back and reading it, you know, lots of people like to reread books. I'm not fond of rereading books because, as I said, they've become historical. I've moved on, time has moved on, and I'm not going to read the book in the same way. If it's a book I really loved, I think I can dilute the impact of it with a reread. And other people, you know, want to read a book at different times in their life and always get new things out of it. So, you know, we're all different. Readers are all different, just like writers are all different. And, you know, but that's what makes it fun. Patrick, why don't you come join this discussion, since I'm in danger of disintegrating into actual politics.
We're good.
Okay. Well, let's see. Let me just check and see if we have any questions, because I don't want to get into politics either, because I have my opinions, and they might not be shared by people watching. Let's see. Okay, Tracy would like to know. She says, "Hi, Chris. Now that you're four books in, what do you like most besides holding your latest book in your hands about being a published author?"
What do I like most about being a published author?
That's a good question.
I mean, it's super fun to go to book events and meet readers and talk with Barbara and go to book festivals. That's all well and good, and social media needs to be done. What I really love the most, and what I'm dying to get back to in about a week and a half, is just sitting down and making, you know, putting words on paper. And as I, you know, go further and further in this transition from being a screenwriter to being an author, I feel like I'm developing more facility for it. And so it continues just to be so much fun to write these books. And I've completed a first draft of the next book, and gonna do a rewrite on it. And I just can't wait to get back to it. So it's just getting the chance, the opportunity to make stuff that is gonna leave my desk and end up in people's hands. I mean, it's a hell of a gift. And so I consider myself very fortunate.
I need to ask you a question, because I keep looking at, also by Chris Haughty, at the in my finished copy of the book, and you keep talking about four books, but there are in fact four books here, and therefore by my count this is your fifth book. So what is Insurrection Day?
Well, Insurrection Day was a novella done. There was the first two books came out in January, and then the third and fourth book came out in May. And so my very wonderful book agent, Dan Conaway, suggested that I write a novella to kind of, you know, because they were going to be not 12 months between books, but 18 months between books, that I write something and perhaps Atria would agree to put it out there. And they did. And so then I had to come up with an idea, because I had already written, I think I may have already written Storm Rising by that point. And so I knew what Storm Rising was about. You know, like I said earlier, it was the white supremacy in the US military, among other things. And I think not too long after Dan had made that suggestion, January 6th happened. And so that was impactful. Speaking of, you know, historical novels and mucking around with the actual events. So there was a photograph of two congressional interns, two female congressional interns, and they were carrying the ballot box that, you know, they were January 6th, they were trying to stop the count. And so I probably posted something on Twitter or something, put that picture up and said something about, wow, that looks like, you know, one of those young ladies could be Haley Chill. And that got the wheel started. And so Insurrection Day is Haley's intervention in January 6th, when rioters are storming the Capitol building. And in this case, I made them, as always in my books, I took out any particular political party out of the protesters, out of the book entirely, and just made them, they were protesting some, I can't even remember, I think it was a Supreme Court decision or executive order that pissed off a bunch of white supremacists. And so that storms the Capitol, and that dovetails with what happens next in Storm Rising. So the books do follow a chronology.
So when you were talking about 4.5 books, was the half book?
Yes.
That book?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Because I was thinking it was the half of whatever book you were writing. So I'm glad I should have asked you that question at the beginning. All right. We've cleared that up for everybody. Wonderful. Okay, Patrick. Has anybody asked about Chris's writing style? Because that always, her writing process, that is always a popular question.
No, but that is a good question. Do you have any kind of advice for aspiring writers? Perhaps?
Don't do it.
Doug is still an aspiring writer.
Make friends with Doug. That'll be the way to do it, right?
Make friends with Doug. He's a man with very many good ideas. Advice, you know, someone, my good friend David Temple asked me that same question during a podcast that he posted for me last week. And the best I came up with, and it sounds a little crass, but it was, my simple tip was, don't be boring. You know, I always, you know, again, it gets back to being an anxious screenwriter who, you know, lives and dies by the words on those pages. And you need to really always defy expectations. You need to say things in interesting ways. And that's the smallest way of like how you use your words and your language, all the way up to, you know, those big macro elements in your book, like, oh, we know this is going to be a politically motivated attack on the Supreme Court. And then you pull the rug out from underneath your reader and turn the story in a different direction. And that, you know, for me, I probably have it posted somewhere on a yellow post-it near my computer, and essentially it's don't be boring.
Don't be boring. Leave out the parts that people skip.
Right? Yeah, you know, I mean, many people, many more famous authors have like Elmore Leonard has said it in ways that are, they're more elegant. And
I leave out the parts people don't want to read.
Yeah. Yeah. I did know that.
So I stepped on your line. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's all right.
That's really about it. We have somebody who says that she's sitting in West Hollywood near Book Soup watching. Well, maybe she needs to get down to Book Soup.
See, that's the thing about streaming is that it becomes a kind of Netflix operation. And we know that we have, to a great degree, suppressed audience at the Poison Pen because we stream all of our events. Mm-hmm. And, you know, often it's more appealing to put on your jammies and, you know, grab a snack and sit down and watch it than to drive 40 miles across, you know, Metro Phoenix. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think COVID changed so many things about how we live and how we consume entertainment or how we do things. And, you know, streaming has changed everything, has changed the movie. That's why we're having a writer's strike as we speak, you know. So we're all adjusting to this reality, but it takes cooperation from authors like you, Chris, who are willing to sign books and, you know, support the video parts, the streaming parts, so that it still works as though it were a live event. So,
well, yeah. Next book, I'm going to insist that I come out to beautiful Scottsdale. I always love.
We'd love to have you. And, you know, now that you've tantalized us by not telling us anything about the next book.
Big book. It's going to be a good one. I can promise. Big book.
I'm delighted to hear it. And, you know, I'm glad that you feel like you should do something, whatever this is, different. Because I think that's good for a writer, you know, not to just get in the groove to the point where it's not exciting. So
sure, how you do.
Well, have a wonderful time at your live event at Book Soup. Many thanks to the owners of Book Soup for making this possible right there. And as Pat is pointing out, and I will point out, we do still have a very few autographed copies left of The Devil You Know. So I urge you to grab one and enjoy it. Right.
Thank you so much, guys.
You bet.
Yeah.
Have fun. Bye, everybody.
Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.